Yeah, I think that's a good shot.
We can all rock and stay in the picture.
You can rock. You can get up.
I just
up.
Want to make sure that yeah.
You can dance if you want.
Oh.
In fact, you know, we need more dance in this podcast. Really.
All right.
You might catch a hummingbird or two.
I know. I was hoping.
Beautiful.
Actually.
That was
yeah.
fantastic. Yeah.
Earlier when you were chatting, one kept coming up behind you.
Yeah.
When we were giving you that rapt attention, really we were just looking above your head at the hummingbird.
I thought you were just enchanted by my halo.
Yes! Yes.
Well, welcome to another episode of The Transcendiates with the Swedenborg Foundation. Today we are quite honored to have some wonderful guests with us today. Dr. George Dole, the author of a new publication by the Swedenborg Foundation, The Universe and I, Where Science and Spirituality Meet, which is an amazing book that we'll talk a little bit more about in a minute, and also by a wonderful, hopefully return guest on the show, Roslyn Taylor. So thank you for sitting down with us today.
Glad to be with you.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The ball is in your court.
Well, I think that sounds about right. I feel really honored right now to be in your space, this wonderful cabin in Maine. Tell us about just where we are and its history to you.
Yeah, we are on the shores of Lake Androscoggin in sort of south-central Maine, in a property that I believe my grandfather bought around 1908, or sometime between 1906 and 1908, which has sort of grown like Topsy. Lovely place, quiet place. This means I'm the third generation here. It's now occupied more by my son Andrew and his family than by my wife and me, because they have a couple of kids and they have a need to escape. I've sort of outgrown a lot of the things that appeal to me, the swimming, the sailing and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
Love the peace and quiet, which is not as much more available when the kids aren't around than it is when they are. But I'm delighted to have this to hand on to another couple of generations. It is on the west shore, on the east shore rather, so we look out toward the sunsets. We have an open view of the lake, a natural beach, no drop-off, wonderful for little children. And let them splash around in the sand and so on. And there's a little story of when my father and mother were at a Maine Council of Churches meeting, conference meeting, and Dad had gone upstairs and was coming back down to the group, and she heard him mutter, "Let's go to Wayne." when he wanted to get away from everything, that was his phrase, "Let's go to Wayne." Yeah.
Oh, nice. Well, it's wonderful that your family is this place to escape to and come together and beautiful activities and connection.
It is quite
the view. This is
beautiful.
Yeah, just being here for a few minutes is quite a blessing, I'm feeling. Yeah.
And I don't know whether the video is showing the lake at all, but
unfortunately, it would wash out your beautiful faces. So.
But it's about a mile and a half to the other side, and I think Corey and Ross will both tell you. It's pretty quiet out there. There is not a lot of boat traffic going on. There are no boats buzzing the beach, anything like that. It is almost primitive.
It's amazing.
And
Roslyn, why are you in Maine right now?
The reason I'm here at the moment is I'm attending the Freiburg New Church Assembly in Freiburg, Maine, about an hour and a half I guess, drive from here.
And that's a camp.
And that's a camp. Well, okay. It's an assembly because we are in New England, but other people would call it a camp. Actually, I think in Maine terminology, this is a camp.
Yeah, this is a camp. Called a camp.
Oh. This is a camp.
Really?
A camp is your place out in the woods, and an assembly is where people come together in their camps in the woods or something like that.
Oh, whoa. I have no idea.
I'm making up these definitions as I go along, but...
Well, this is my second time at the assembly, and I didn't know that that was the reason for the name.
I actually don't know either, but I do know, for instance, in Brynathyn, I guess they're using the term assembly there more traditionally, but like when they had a building that they built around the same time as this in the early 1900s where the congregation would gather for social events, and that was the assembly hall, you know, and assemblies of people. But yeah, that seems to be a New England or a Maine terminology, that the camp, what you and I maybe would call a camp, is an assembly of people coming together.
Well, it's quite the assembly of people there.
Yes.
You know? So. And you have quite the history at that assembly as well.
Yeah, Deb, my father was one of the founders.
Oh, well.
He was minister in Freiburg at the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and one of the Whiteheads was the inspirer, main inspirer. Dad was his aide-de-camp, I think, and ran the camp for a good many years. I was born in Freiburg, and
that's great.
In the parsonage.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
So your wonderful wife tells us.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And your dad was a Swedenborgian minister.
Yeah, and my grandfather, who was the one who bought this place initially.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What are the duties of a Swedenborgian minister? I'm curious.
You are one, right?
Just recently.
Now you're asking.
Yeah, I'm asking.
What are my duties to me?
Yeah.
It would be good to know, right?
Yeah, I think...
Because you are one, too.
They are not precisely defined.
No.
There are certainly some liturgical, is that privilege or obligations, baptizing, marrying, conducting the Holy Supper, Holy Supper is really reserved to the clergy. Baptism, the clergy very much preferred, but not absolutely necessary. I think if you look at convention's history and practice, you'll find that more than in most mainline churches, the pastor is expected to be a teacher and to know the church's doctrines very thoroughly and to teach them. But the pastoral side has also been very strong in convention. That is, to be there with the people, for the people, and to be there lifelong, so to speak, from cradle to grave, and to live with the church and foster the spiritual growth of the church's members. I suspect that more subconsciously than consciously there's been an effort to promote harmony within the congregation. And this will, of course, vary with the sensitivity and the aggressiveness of the leadership style of the pastor. And some pastors have been much more controlling than others. Some have expected more of their congregations, some less.
Makes sense.
But
yeah, I'm hearing him just very well. Yeah.
Can I make him talk? talk up a little more if you can.
Oh, okay.
And thankfully, this mic is looks like it's able to pick up all three of us, so that's nice.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's, I've mentioned earlier about this cochlear implant. I hear my voice louder than other people do.
Oh, yeah.
So then you tone it down because you think you're too loud and maybe you overcorrect.
I don't want to be bellowing at people. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you just got a new...
new cochlear implant a couple of months ago.
Oh.
And there is a period of adjustment in which I still am.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My grandfather, he speaks very softly now for the same reason.
Yeah.
You know, it can be really jarring to hear your voice so loudly.
You want to talk at a particular sound level.
Mm.
It's just as a matter of courtesy, and you're used to it, and you do it automatically.
Mm.
And in order to do that, you listen to what your voice sounds like to you.
Yeah.
And if that doesn't. What my brain is now doing is trying to rebalance having the inner signals and the outer signals both boosted.
Mm.
And now my brain has to quiet down those inner signals.
Mm.
And as it does, I will just naturally start talking what will seem to you to be louder.
Yes. Ah, yes.
Well.
And what to me feels really artificially loud feels like my public speaking voice. This is what I have to do to reach the people in the back row.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm.
Well, and you two have known each other for a few years now?
A few years. Not as long as I wish I'd met George a long time ago. Yeah, I would say from my perspective, you know, I was well aware of your translations and stuff, and I actually first met... your relatives, I guess, Trevor and Ian Woofenden, I was in college. So that's a long time ago.
Yeah.
So that's when I sort of kind of on the sidelines thought of you as Uncle George. And I never even met you, but you were like Uncle George, you know. But finally, I think I was in my 30s or something before I met you at anything at the Swedenborg Foundation. And, you know, your reputation, of course, you know, as a scholar and everything had preceded you as well as the Uncle George version of you. So I was, you know. But any time I've been with you, it's, you know, fantastic.
Yeah.
I feel like it's
but
a
they've
gift.
Been very widely spaced.
Widely spaced.
And not very long.
Yeah, duration. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. Well, it's nice that we get to hang out today together.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
You may notice if you're a fan of the Swedenborg Foundation, George's name on a number of... our publications, specifically and most preeminently right now with the New Century Edition translations of Swedenborg's books, correct?
Yeah.
Mm. And actually maybe most preeminently this wonderful new book, The Universe and I. Tell us a little bit about this book. It's short, but it's heavy. It's like really amazing.
Yeah. It really started with an appreciation of the extent to which Swedenborg was both scientist and theologian, and that he really was on the cutting edge in both things at once, so to speak. He had an international reputation in the field of science. And then he wound up, I may come back to this later, becoming a very articulate advocate of a strong sense of spirituality, of a very present, urgent, and incredibly relevant spirituality. Nothing... fantastic, wishy-washy, dreamy, otherworldly-like about it. And there was one remark about, I recall, that of I think it was of Kenneth Ring talking about near-death experiences, that Swedenborg's picture of the spiritual world was made a lot of just plain rational sense. And the motto of the church that is now permitted to enter intelligently into the mysteries of faith. As young Dick Toffel once said, you don't have to change your breath. When you come to church, you don't have to check your brains at the door. And then looking at some of the so-called new atheism began to be looked into Stephen Hawking and a few other people who were writing, and discovered that on that border of science, there are some serious questions being raised about strictly materialistic determinism and the notion, as one writer puts it, he's in there somewhere, that you can explain everything by the way it is made up of smaller things. That the behavior of small particles determines the behavior of bigger ones, determines the behavior of molecules, determines the behavior of cells, determines the behavior of your brain, and so on and so forth. And if only we can understand the machine completely, we'll know everything.
Yes.
And that is beginning to come under a serious question, and I think the door is open for the kind of conversation I'm trying to promote. So I got busy trying to look at what I could find that was sort of written on that fringe.
Is that called reductionism? With that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where, yeah, everything, you can explain everything perfectly if you just knew all the details and what would happen next.
Yeah, it is a materialistic determinism that you can explain everything by looking at its past. And one of the mysteries that they find that they can't really explain but expect to someday, I guess, is how did this crazy idea of purpose ever get started?
It reminds me of something that I've heard from like reading physicists, this idea that there's so many universes, we just happen to be in the perfect one, of course, because otherwise we couldn't reflect. But even the idea that there's multiple universes is kind of a belief or a theory, almost to support, you know, how impossible this one seems. There must be a lot of trials out there to get something so great as this, right?
Yeah.
I'm curious, how does that strike you, the perfection and beauty of this universe?
Yeah, I'm very, very fond, have been for some time, of Teilhard de Chardin and the Phenomenon of Man, and his insistence that nothing could emerge that wasn't in some form present. And physics talks a great deal about gradual different things emerging at different stages of evolution. And that is a metaphor. And I think if it is pursued, obviously, nothing can emerge. Venus can't emerge from the ocean if she wasn't already in it, so to speak. And one of my aha moments was when I woke up to the fact that the Latin verb existere, which has been translated to exist, which is disastrous, one of its primary meanings is to emerge.
Yes.
And that's a key theme in this book, emergence.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it is the key concept in the whole metaphor of evolution.
Yes, definitely.
And one of the books I cite in there, Moskowitz, I think, or no, Borovitz, I think, 13 discrete stages, and one of the most baffling ones, as far as materialism is concerned, is the emergence of mind and consciousness. And how could they emerge if they weren't there to begin with?
Right. Well, from my very superficial, I don't read physicists, but like, you know, reading about physicists or science, is that it's in that area of the study of consciousness that the God question has come up amongst scientists. Like, you come up to this reality that there's something there. I don't know, yeah. Do you have... Yeah. I'm not sure in your book, because I've only read the first four chapters, but, I mean, have you covered that, or what are your thoughts about the sort of the God question as people bump up against it in the study of consciousness?
Yeah. Well, I would say, first of all, that I don't think you'll find any serious grown-up theologians who will not say that we cannot... God is ultimately undefinable. Mm. If you include in your definition of God the word infinite, that means having no boundaries. Mm. And that includes boundaries of meaning. It means you cannot define God, because that would mean drawing a line around God. That would mean limiting God's infinity. And in a sense, dumbing him down to something within the scope of our own comprehension.
That's how some people...
Yeah, and there is a major strain of theology called apophatic, which dwells on that. We are incapable of understanding the infinite. Our minds are finite, and we cannot encompass the infinite. I'm credited, I think, properly to George Santayana. We may never know who discovered water, but we can be sure it wasn't a fish.
Right.
You cannot observe anything objectively if you can't get outside it. Mm. Can't see it from the outside. And one of the things we can't see objectively is consciousness. We can look at what it does, or try to figure out what it does, how it behaves, and so on. But we, in order to define it, we have to use it.
Yes.
We cannot, and that is a subjective exercise. Our concepts of consciousness are necessarily subjective, which is almost by definition non-scientific.
Hmm. Yeah, I feel like often we kind of discount how different concepts of God may show up around us, just almost like the universe is speaking to us about the fundamental nature of consciousness in a way, or of divinity, or of ourselves. And what do you think about metaphor in scripture and in nature, and how God reveals him or herself to us?
Yeah. One way I can define you without using any kind of language or metaphor is
right there.
Whatever it is, that's it. Yeah. As soon as I try to describe anything, I begin to need metaphors of one sort or another. And especially when it comes to defining anything that I can't see, like an affection, I have nothing to work with but metaphors. You say, no, that's a hard question. Hard is a metaphor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you could also say, like you said, anything that you say about anything is a metaphor, in the sense that that object has an independent existence, and you're only referring to it. You're describing it. When I say the word fish, or you just said the word fish, it brings up something in my mind that is my picture of a fish, but isn't a fish.
Yeah.
It's a fish is a metaphor for that thing that swims in the lake or whatever.
Which sneaks up on one of my favorite distinctions, and that is the difference between a word and a term.
Oh, okay.
A term scientifically is something quite exclusive, we'll put it this way, as a term, the word dog has a very, very definable meaning. Some creatures are dogs and some creatures aren't, and they have characteristics, and you can draw a sharp line around that category. As a word, dog has meanings that range all over the place.
Right.
It is metaphorical in many ways. And in talking about most of the things that matter most to us, we're always groping for images of something the other person can observe physically, so that we know we're talking about the same thing. I can't show you how I feel, but I can tell you that I'm cooling off, or so on. I can refer to a physical experience that may suggest the way I feel.
Your book talks about this tension between, and correct me if I'm wrong, like integration and differentiation.
Yeah.
And you say it a few different ways. Could you tell us about what that means?
Yeah. This really came home to me from two books. One was The Journey of the Universe, with its statement right up at the beginning. From the very beginning, the universe was forming relationships, and they were referring to the fact that as the Big Bang is currently conceived, one of the first things that happened was that particles began to form, and that they began to aggregate and form units that could aggregate to make even bigger, more complex units, and so on. That was one thing, that universe as starting from the beginning, forming relationships by differentiation into particles and integration of those particles into larger complexes.
Yes.
And the remark of Robert Keegan in his book, The Evolving Self, that he sees, which is a study of lifelong psychological or psycho-spiritual personal growth, sees this as fueled by two fundamental human yearnings, I think he calls them, or needs, the need for a sense of individuality and the need to belong, the need for companionship. And he sees us, the growth process, as a spiral in which there are times at which we desperately need company, need companionship, need support, and we rely heavily on it. And then there are times when we figure, I need to find out who I am. I'm getting swallowed up this. I've got to cut loose. And then we do get into that, and then after a while we begin to feel lonely again and come back in, but we don't come back in at the same level that we left. We come back as knowing ourselves better and having more to offer, and entering more consciously into a, I think probably you could say, a larger community. And this continues, this object relations theory. And one of the nice little ways he describes this early on is to say, a little child is its impulses. And a significant thing happens when it begins to observe its impulses as something it has, rather than something that it is feeling them as something that it is, and begins to dialogue with them. It have some choice as to how to respond to them. Hmm. And sees us as this is going on increasingly sophisticated, in the best sense of the word, complex level, at some more complex levels. And the ideal form of employment is to find a job that you really believe in and that you really love to do, and that is, you find is needed.
Yes.
So that you are satisfying the needs of your community and finding personal satisfaction in doing that. And this makes for a truly, truly healthful community.
Mm.
But this community will also likely be in a course of change. And it may need to take time to define itself, and it may find time to look for companionship. So and this is a very Swedenborgian idea that's beautifully handled in the chapter titles near the beginning of Heaven and Hell. The entire heaven is in the human form. Every community in the heavens is in a human form. Therefore, every member of one of these communities is in the human form. And this means the community isn't in the human form because it's made up of humans.
Mm.
We're human because of the human form of community.
Mm.
And it winds up in Heaven and Hell, I think 420, forgive me. we are accepted into heaven when we accept heaven into ourselves.
Yeah. And that's when
not
that
otherwise.
That's how we become human.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I am a member of the community of the city of Bath to the extent that I take that community to heart. And I am concerned with its well being. And not otherwise.
Especially in the spiritual sense.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Which is not all that far under the surface.
No.
It keeps sticking its head up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we tend to talk in kind of a spiritual sense, metaphorical way, especially when we, speak about each other and about how we connect. And I don't think it's an accident that, you know, as you said, it's the spirit, this more real kind of reality is just below the surface of, you know, what we can often interpret as just a classical physics universe.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And there's that principle in divine providence that evils can't be dealt with until they appear. Well, we can prevent them from appearing. We can deny their appearance. The Cuyahoga River doesn't have to catch fire in order to convince us that we ought to clean up our rivers. The signals are there if we are willing to look at, willing to see them. So it doesn't mean that we have to kill each other in order to find out that we shouldn't.
Oh my. What you said earlier about the ideal job occupation or whatever is something, you know, that springs from such love that, you know, just sort of formed a personal question for you, for me, which was like when you look back over your long career, and you did mention to me earlier off camera, so to speak, that you had felt called to ministry from the very beginning.
Yeah.
But when you think back about all the places you've been in your ministry and the things that you've done, is there any part of it, or you know, reflect on where it felt like you were doing who George Dole really is? The love that's within you or whatever, you know.
Boy, I would need to be professionally debriefed, I think.
did I ask a question that George Dole couldn't handle?
Drag through there. Yeah.
Well, what's the first thing that comes to your mind about the joy in your life of being a minister?
Like a gets his humility from his father.
He
was a very humble gentleman.
Get your humility from your father.
A tremendous amount of who I am was formed early by a very deep admiration of my father. It was very, very self-effacing in a sense. Not very solid, absolutely reliable, very, very straightforward. A moment that has stuck with me. I remember being a passenger when he was driving us somewhere, and looking over and seeing his hand on the steering wheel, and it just said who he was. You know, it was there, solid, in control, absolutely reliable.
That's wonderful.
Total trustworthiness, so to speak. And I associated that with the profession of ministry. But at any rate, I know when he died, at that time we had moved out, of course, and hadn't realized that his health was failing, so it came as a surprise. But one of the first things that crossed my mind was, I don't have to worry about disappointing him anymore.
Oh, wow.
And I realized how much that had been one of my constant criteria.
You mentioned the freedom of ministry in a way earlier when I asked you about, you know, what's the definition or what's the responsibilities for Swedenborgian ministers. Is that something that speaks to you, the story that you just shared about, you know, feeling a little bit more freedom, you know, knowing that you don't have to live up to his expectations or just trying to, you know, please him?
Basically it came as a call to more responsibility. Simply, I can't take this for granted anymore. I have to examine and in a sense I have to become more me. That is a huge responsibility. The image was a marvelous, I think, invaluable crutch to get me to that point, but it wasn't there anymore.
What about you, Rosalind? You're on a journey to become a minister as well.
Yes.
how does that strike you with the call to ministry?
Well, I have probably the inverse kind of story to George. I guess the similarity was that I was called to ministry as a child. When I was somewhere around between 8 and 10 years old, I had the thought, if I was a boy, I would be a minister or a doctor. But I'm a girl, I can't be a minister, so I'll be a doctor.
Uh-huh.
So I actually pursued medical education and in the end decided to be a nurse, and so I've been a nurse for a long time. But that call to ministry was always there, never went away. And so it surfaced in different things like teaching Sunday school, music ministry, very always involved in the life of the church. Until like I was in my mid-30s when I just kind of realized that thinking was incorrect that I had as a child.
Yeah.
I am a woman, but I can also be a minister. There's things that I can do. And that's sort of like the sense of responsibility of being who you really are, because from a young age, minister was in me. You know, minister was what I was supposed to be.
Yeah.
And because I was in a faith community that didn't ordain women, you know, I held myself to that restriction. I let that in. And so I trained as a chaplain and I worked as a chaplain and eventually, you know, came to the belief that I could be ordained and be a minister, you know, a Swedenborgian New Church minister. I kid around that this is the slowest, second career change in the history of humankind, because I'm almost old enough to retire, so I really do hope to be ordained before I retire. But in my journey towards ministry through chaplaincy and other things, you know, I have been able to minister a home church in Brynathyn for 15 years, edit a volume, you know, a book that was published, self-published by a group of people on wholeness theology, and now working on another collaborative writing project on a woman's companion to conjugal love. So, yes, I've been doing ministry things, being a chaplain. I would say when I asked you that question about where's your joy been in being a minister, you know, where you felt like your love was most able to be manifested. Somebody had asked me that question recently, and the answer for me was the 2 years pretty much when I was an oncology cancer chaplain at one of the bigger hospitals in Philadelphia, the University of Pennsylvania Hospital. Because, yeah, but when I did that job, I felt like I was really being who I could be. It brought together my knowledge of medical things and nursing and ministry, you know, the skills that I had developed through my training, you know, to be a chaplain and listen and walk with somebody through that experience and their family. You know, for me, that was, I've already done that. I've already had the experience of the joy of my ministry, and I'm not even ordained yet.
Yes. You're ordained in your heart.
Yes, yeah. Ordained. Well, you know, that's an expression that they used in chaplain training, is that you're ordained as the minister for this patient the minute you walk through the door.
Mm-hmm.
They've ordained you.
Yeah.
They've put you in line, you know, ordered, you know, everything's come together, and you have walked in the room, and you are the minister, or you are the chaplain, you are the clergy, the spiritual, you know, the one that's helping them in their relationship with the divine, however you define that, you know.
Yeah.
They ordain you each
they
time.
They may have some very strange definitions of what the minister is.
Well, that's true, but they ordained you to be that which, you know, they want. And if you can, you try to be that.
You try to figure out what they want.
So yeah. Right.
Even if you disappoint them, they'll still consider you a minister, probably.
Yeah.
No, but your question did start my mind working along a particular thing, and I think has clarified something for me. That is that my first 10 years or so of parish ministry seemed very satisfactory. They seemed to be going well. The church had been taking in some new members and in Cambridge and so on, and people seemed pleased with what I was doing. And then I began to feel discontented with it. And the main thing was, it seemed to me as though they were content with too little.
Oh.
They were content with a nice Sunday service and so on and so forth. They didn't really want much more than that. And got invited to teach part-time at the seminary. That's a long story, which I will therefore not tell. And that went well enough that the time came down, and that I think I liked better because it asked more of me.
Mm.
And the Cambridge Church did not have an office. I was living in Newton, and nothing during the course of the week actually called me. I could be preparing for things for the weekend, and there might be people I needed to call on. There weren't very many, as far as that concerned, but it just seemed like too little and unfulfilling in that sense. And when it came to teaching at the school, the demands went up, and they were in areas that where I was competent, and that was in many ways more satisfactory.
What was that like? What did you teach?
I prevailed upon them to give me the official title of eventually became professor of Bible, languages, and theology. And I chose those in that order because that's BLT, and those are initials that I can remember.
It was important. Wow.
Connection to something else that's really important.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it did, you know, the biblical background, and I did teach some Swedenborg's Latin, and so and I was capable of teaching either Hebrew. Not too strong on New Testament Greek, because my college Greek had been classical, strictly.
Oh.
But certainly capable of teaching it with a textbook if anybody wanted it.
Didn't you write a textbook? You wrote a textbook.
I wound up writing an introduction to Swedenborg's Theological Latin.
Oh, right.
Yeah, a little textbook, which is, I think, conceptually very strong. But what it doesn't have is what it needed, is a lot of exercises so that you're drilled,
yes,
drilled in it. And that would have been that would have made a much bigger book. I think that the skeleton of a very good program is there.
Mm.
And a good teacher could muster up some exercises to use it, but it's not a very good teacher, self-study.
Mm.
So when does that edition come out?
That has been out for a long time.
No, with the exercise.
Oh, oh. As soon as you get with it, start using it.
We'll direct that to someone listening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That has incidentally been translated into Japanese.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
I don't know how well.
Japanese wasn't one of your languages.
You noticed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was the process getting this published?
Hmm?
What was the process like getting this published? The Universe and I.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Took a while.
That's interesting. It actually, I wrote it with a great deal of enthusiasm and submitted the manuscript to the foundation. They were very affirmative, but they wanted to have the science checked up on, so they referred it out to a couple of scientists. I got critiques back from them and did some rewriting. Didn't require a lot. And resubmitted it. But all in all, it was at least 4 years between the time I submitted this manuscript before it went to press.
And is that longer than usual?
I think they were just getting started with their online mm-hmm. programs, and that was taking a lot of time. A lot of personnel hours were going into that. And it did not get to the copy editor. Spent over almost 2 years between basic approval of the manuscript and getting it to the copy editor. And then the copy editor was part-time and very, very supportive and helpful, but didn't get far into it before she resigned and had to be replaced and find somebody else. And he was longer on promises than on production, and so it was at least another year before he actually got right with it. And then he moved through it quite well and quickly and did a very... He's Bob Connolly. No, John.
John Connolly?
Yeah.
Mm.
Wound up liking very much. Mm. Very impressed with him. He's, as far as I'm concerned, he's a potential author himself. He's got a fine mind and certainly the language skills.
Yeah, he's amazing.
To write well and intelligently.
So you enjoyed working with him?
Yeah, very much. Oh. Very much so.
That's great.
Yeah.
I noticed his name a few times in the book.
Yeah.
In the footnotes.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm. And that's because he pursued lines of inquiry. On his own. Nobody asked him to do this. He was just got engaged with the ideas and made connections that I hadn't made.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of those references are some cool, like you bring in these kind of other ideas that really fit and express the point really well, and some of those he
And that really is what I hope for from the book, is that it, it become and part of an ongoing conversation. And the idea that it should answer all the questions, it should raise at least as many as it answers. And provoke further inquiry. But I do believe very strongly that it points in a constructive direction.
Oh my gosh. I'm sure you feel the same way. This is, it really is a potent book, and not in a way that's, you know, feels like way over my head, as many, you know, many books on the subject are. I feel like I can digest it, but it also gets to the heart of things that often takes an entire book to get to that point. You know, that's almost every page I feel that way. I think that's really amazing. It's really beautiful. How do you feel about what you've read so far? I'm curious.
Just sort of first blush reading it, I feel like I've sort of got the point of what this chapter's about, I think, pretty much. You know, yeah, that's all right. Then I reread it, you know, and then I can follow it along. Like, it takes a couple readings for me. Well, I've only done two readings, really, but, you know, definitely takes two readings to sort of get the nuanced understanding of exactly what it is that you know, like how Stephen Hawking's saying and how you're critiquing it, you know. But so that's why you say a potent book, because there's possibilities for so many lines of thought. Like, I read two sentences and just have to ponder that and read a little bit more. I mean, I used to, well, I mean, Swedenborg was definitely like that for me when I was younger, but becoming sort of fluent in Swedenborg, I can now just, you know, read through, and it, you know, it clicks in my mind because I've spent so many years reading Swedenborg, right? I think if I read in this genre enough, I probably would be able to read your book. I'm like, oh yeah, of course, yeah, I thought that too. Yeah, this is, you know, but I have my own little thoughts about the universe and, you know, the theological implications of that. And, you know, I hear enough people who know some things about quantum physics speaking that I sort of have a superficial understanding of it, but quantum mechanics, I'm sorry.
Have you, either of you, read Lewis Field Height's Ultimate Reality?
No.
I think, yeah.
Ultimately, but you're recommending it.
He taught it at our theological school. I think he probably was one of the best minds the church has produced. And one of my thumbnail sketches of him was that if I read 3 pages of Height, I want to take 4 pages of notes.
Yes.
I'm also a great fan of Strunk and White.
Grammar and diction and whatnot.
Oh, okay.
And there, whole philosophy is say something once, right.
Right.
Don't say it 7 times, nearly right, in order to support, so that people can find the right that you're trying to find. Yeah. And it does make for the kind of writing that you're talking about. I need to stop and think.
Yes.
That's not bad.
No. That's actually, you know, not at all. It's a great experience.
That's how I felt towards Swedenborg.
Yes.
Well, I still feel that way towards Swedenborg when I'm reading him. Just, I have to stop and, like, meditate until I fall asleep, you know.
Yes.
It's so deep, you know.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that, this contribution. And I really think everyone should pick it up, honestly. And that's not just because you're on the show. It's an amazing text. And you mentioned Stephen Hawking a moment ago, and I'm curious. You dialogue with Stephen in a way in a number of places in this book.
Yeah.
And tell us a little bit about how he shows up.
I wish his English was as good as his physics, in a sense.
His meaning is sometimes...
Yeah, and there's a couple of things in there, for example, where he says on one page he's very much into model-dependent realism. We can't really see beyond what we can see. We do the best we can. And then, but then on consecutive pages, he objects to the idea that we can do more than this. And then says that, makes some remark about the way Newtonian physics provides us a way of describing events. And then on the next page says, I'd have to look it up to see. Physics now tells us how things really are, almost.
He almost
verbally contradicts himself.
In
that sense, and I just would want to push him on that
It sounds like you often agree with one of his statements, and it's like, but then maybe later he'll disagree with it to make this other point, and never really delves into the meaning of that kind of potent statement, and dismisses how the meaning in the universe, but sometimes says it.
Well, he says it at some point, I forget where, we still, what is the fire that makes things go, so to speak? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big question that he keeps ignoring.
Well, he's obviously, by posing that question, puzzled by it and aware of there's something else. That's why I thought it was amazing when you included that quote in the book. I'd never heard any reference to Stephen Hawking even asking that question. What is the fire that... I could almost find the page. it was a great quote. I won't be able to because it's not, my copy has it marked. But, his awareness that there is more, which sort of, to me, gives me a little sense of forgiveness for his contradictory statements. I'm going to say, as a Swedenborgian, I'm very used to paradoxical, contradictory statements because it depends... Like in Swedenborg, it depends on the point of view that he is, seeing things in the spiritual world is how he reports it, and it can be confusing. So I sort of had this feeling like, well, I can cut Stephen Hawking a bit of a break because, he's looking at theories of universe and of being and the existere and so forth. And depending on which perspective he's taking in that particular context that he's writing from, he might be seeing different sides of it or different, But the fact that he would ask that question to me was amazing.
Yeah.
What is that fire that gives energy to these processes and makes us want to know or something like that? Like, it was a very philosophical question that transcended a lot of the sort of scientific approach that he needs to take as a physicist. And then you can sort of feel the humanity of the man. I can be in my trained physicist mind, but I also have this experience of there's a fire that illuminates and excites everything. Like, what is that? So that was really good.
Imagine what he must be feeling now that he's in the spiritual world.
Yes.
Yeah. Probably turning handsprings.
That. Yeah, that would be the first thing, wouldn't it? Yeah,
I find your dialogue with him amazing, and not just in the kind of the contradictory ways, but uplifting these really insightful things from Stephen Hawking that we don't always run into in the way in this light. There's a lot of really insightful things in terms of specific theories and mathematics and.
Yeah.
And I find that really cool. It's really fun to engage with that.
Yeah.
Was it fun to put it together?
It was. Yeah, I had a lot of momentum, and it was, frankly, it was very disappointing to see how slow the publication process was.
I
was pretty sure that they looked on it very favorably and that they wanted to do it. I didn't know whether it would ever get rise to the top of their priority list. To get done.
This process.
Yeah.
Although it sounds like, you know, it ended up okay.
I think so.
Oh, great.
I wish I knew of a way to get it reviewed outside church circles to get at least one review in a respected periodical.
Yeah.
And that I think, you know, that the little blurb on the back by Greenstein I liked very much. Finds fascinating resonances between the spiritual and material worlds, moving us to a more nuanced conception of causality. Mm. And that is exactly the kind of reaction I would hope for, that it moves the conversation, so to speak. And I would hope that somebody in the scientific field would, and in the theological field preferably, would see this. You know, this is worth promoting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we've written very many things from Swedenborg's point of view that we're consciously trying to be part of an existing conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly it's going, here are the answers, because we know the questions that you should be asking.
And that's what Apple does. It works out for them.
That
makes sense.
Instead of saying, what questions are you asking?
Yeah.
And trying to enter into that.
Trying to meet people where they are.
Yeah.
And uplift each other.
Yeah.
Kind of more of an organic way and
connected
way.
And I hope to appreciate how much genuine, honest thought has gone into getting as far as we have gotten. It's not Luddite.
Yes.
No, it's not.
No. How are you doing on your agenda?
I'm doing well. I really appreciated you sharing.
I would like to take about 2 minutes to talk about what I'm doing right now.
Take 2 minutes or
take,
longer.
As of last night, I think I have put virtually the finishing touches on a book on the word explained, on the massive amount that Swedenborg wrote between the beginning of his... between his call and his writing the Arcana.
Wow. Congratulations. You just finished it?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah. Because there's been so much, there's been really a fair amount written on this transition from scientist to theologian, mostly comparing his scientific thought to his published theology. And he wrote thousands of pages in the interim between those two that have been virtually ignored. And they've been published in Latin. He never published them. Published in Latin late in the 19th century, translated into English in the first part of the 20th century, published in facsimile in the early part of the 20th century. It's been there and ignored.
Wow.
And to boil it down, I think it emerges, if you actually look at it, it emerges very clearly that the immediate impact of his entering the spiritual world was a vivid reawakening of his childhood faith.
Mm-hmm.
that had lain dormant on all the years he was climbing the ladder, and he had climbed it to the top, basically, as a scientist, as a diplomat, government, you know, cabinet level government official, international reputation. The family was ennobled. He was the top of the heap. And he, after his call, he kept his job for another couple of years. So he was daytime on that cutting edge, and the College of Mines was at the forefront of the of scientific exploration at that point. That's documented in the book.
In Sweden.
Yeah. Mm. And then he was on another cutting edge when he came back home. And to make it very brief, you begin to pick up, he starts, everything is beautifully clear, wonderful, this is so obvious, it's wonderful, 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 beautifully clear. After a while, he begins to have some questions, and he begins to say his daytime mind, his empirical mind begins to wake up and say, wait a minute, this is...
He says, kind of questioning the childlike faith that he
has. He's questioning
the
childhood faith.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Which is basically all you have to do is trust Jesus. It is that simple. And it's beautiful. And he's not about to give that up. It's very deeply embedded. But it begins more and more to raise hard questions.
Can you see that in... Because he's writing the book, The Word Explained.
Yeah.
Yes. And so can you see his empirical mind entering and doubting as he's writing, explaining the word? He's starting in the beginning of...
The enthusiastic little things begin to fade.
Oh, right.
He says the first hint of something maybe not right is when he gets to the interpretation of the sacrifice of Isaac.
Mm.
And he wants to make that a type, although we can't go into this too carefully, of the crucifixion.
Oh, yes.
But the fact is that Abraham is not sacrificing himself.
Mm, right.
But it is still so clear that this is a kind of mirror that it is beyond doubt.
For most Christians, there would be the similarity between, like, especially if you separate the Father and the Son as separate people. You have the God, the Father, sacrificing the Son.
He doesn't try to sort it out, really.
No.
He tries to say they were so close to each other that they were one, Abraham and his son, and so on and so forth. But he that's the first occurrence, I think, of the word doubt in the whole work.
So he starts kind of grappling with these questions.
So,
of faith.
And then you begin to get, I think... or I expect more, I'll get to this later, you get more and more reservations.
Mm.
And then you get to the point where he is saying, this really is hard. If I cannot take credit for doing anything good, how can I take blame for doing anything wrong, so to speak? Says this goes deep, this I can't handle at this point. And then at one point, the specific point is late in Genesis, in the Joseph story, when the Egyptians sell everything they have in order to buy grain, he identifies with those Egyptians, losing everything. And he says, and I have lost, the cattle correspond to the cognitions and things like this, and the knowledge isn't. And they've given all this up, and this is exactly what has happened to me. Everything I have done so far is worthless.
Mm.
And he quotes a little biblical verse, I await your salvation, God Messiah. Draws a line across the page and leaves the rest of it blank. It is.
And is that all? And then That's the dramatic. End. And that's
and
the.
You don't know how long that blank lasted. Then
oh,
he,
then he picks it up.
Then he gets back to work. And goes back and tries to lay a sound foundation and proceed. And there are there's another crisis later on.
Mm.
And by the end, to shortcut, he mentions along the way falling into periods of doubt and disbelief and being rescued. This comes in fairly early. Then he begins to describe those more vividly, and eventually he describes being surrounded by evil spirits, more or less constantly, battling and getting sunk lower and lower until he finds himself absolutely helpless and hopeless, and then being rescued.
Mm.
And what I'm arguing is that it seems very obvious at this point his empirical discipline is saying exactly the same thing as his childhood faith.
Trust.
You just gotta trust Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all you that's
trust divinity.
All you can do. All you can do. Yeah. And then he comes up with the most wonderful thing. This is after, this comes out of some other manuscripts, as Isaiah Index, that he started after he left off of writing anything consecutive. He was drafting material on the prophets. And at the head of the index, there's a little thing. A change of state in me into the celestial kingdom in an image, and it's dated. Mm. And that's been seen as mysterious.
Yes, into the and celestial
image. On the blank page facing the top, he refers to an entry later in the index to the word help. And comes up with a four-step scheme. It would take too long to do anything but give you the bare bones. At first, we think it's all up to us.
Mm-hmm.
Then, stage two, we realize that it isn't all up to us. And then, stage three, we feel as though we've got to be involved in this somehow. And in stage four, we take no credit. We just stop taking credit. And that is the ultimate goal of the very familiar as if of self paradox, which is a bona fide paradox. We're supposed to resist these evils as if of ourselves. We know that that ain't true.
Yeah.
Evil of selfishness, materialism.
Yeah.
And we get to trouble only when we try to claim it as our own. If we just stop claiming it,
mm-hmm.
we can live with the paradox. It just, why, who cares? I don't care anymore.
Yeah.
So is the Lord doing talking through me, or am I talking? I don't know. I can't prove either way.
Mm.
And so let me just do the best I can.
Wow.
Yeah. But this is embedded in so much biblical stuff. Some of it is fascinating that you... I have to give an overview, a sort of a précis of the whole thing, of the matrix, so that the reader can see this gradually emerge and resolve itself in this kind of profound personal crisis, not just an intellectual solution, a theory that explains everything, but same, both halves of my heart and my brain are now telling me exactly the same thing.
And that you mentioned as this as if of self.
Yeah.
And that's when he brings up kind of this concept of knowing that all your goodness and strength and everything is from God, but that you have to do it as if it's from you, right?
Yeah. And but the kind of knowing is heart, not has to be. This has to be felt, so to speak. This comes out of heaven and hell. I'm pretty sure it's heaven and hell 302, because that's the root number that the Freiburg Assembly is on.
There you go.
Basically, he says the problem is that we. If only we stopped taking credit, we would just accept gratefully what we get from the Lord and just reject what comes into us from the hells. Mm. We wouldn't take credit for the good. We wouldn't take blame for the bad.
Yes. Yeah.
And it is a change in fundamental attitude.
Yes.
Yeah. And it how. Deep down, we have to face our own powerlessness. It will vary from individual to individual, I think. Hmm. But one way or another, we're going to make it.
Mm.
Yeah.
For me, this connects to something you mentioned earlier about the little kid, like no longer identifying with emotions and thoughts anymore, but watching them.
Yeah.
And often in like psychology, that can be used as a therapeutic technique to help people like watch yourself and don't judge necessarily, but just see, okay, this is what Corey's thinking now.
This is what it is thinking in Corey.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the closing quote of this book is from Helen Keller, and it's a very simple one. Is there is joy in self-forgetfulness.
Yes.
That's
great. My.
Mm. That's huge.
It is.
I think that's an excellent closing quote for us today. With the famous Swedenborgian Helen Keller.
Do you have a title for the book?
Yeah.
The tentative title is The High Cost of Vision.
High Cost
of Vision. And subtitle, Critical Years in the Life of Emanuel Swedenborg.
Vision. Being a visionary.
That sounds like an amazing project, and it's complete. You've written it.
Yeah, it's taken about 5 years.
I heard some about your project there in a class I took with you.
Yeah.
Which, I appreciate you sharing your wisdom through the ages with us and connecting. Go ahead.
You've got to be pretty smart to appreciate it.
I'm trying to feel it.
Yes.
Well, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
It's been quite amazing.
Yeah.
And we're looking forward to that next book. In the meantime, we'll have plenty to chew on in these 100 pages.
Yes.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. You didn't bring bathing suits, I imagine.
I did.
Yeah, I did too. We're going to jump in the water.
I do want to jump in the water before we go.
Thank you, Ross, for joining too.
Oh, yes.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Great. Let's see it.
Yeah.